a Christian missionary was murdered in her apartment. The perpetrator left little evidence behind. But a new computer program found clues on a bloody sheet, and the case made forensic history. Kirkland, Washington, an upscale suburb of Seattle, which has some of the best educated citizens in the United States. Over 95% have either a high school or college diploma. 27-year-old Dawn Faring fit right in.
Dawn was very much interested in foreign languages, and she was an exchange student in Paris first and learning French, and then went to Vienna, Austria, and learned German.
Dawn was an accomplished violinist and dancer who had recently returned from Japan, where she was doing Christian missionary work. She was living in this apartment building in Kirkland for just 2 weeks when her neighbor, a local fireman, noticed her front door was left open and decided to investigate.
So he grabbed his portable phone, knocked on the door, called out to see if anyone was there, and when he didn't receive a response, he entered into the unit.
In the kitchen, there were freshly baked cookies.
Dawn?
In the bedroom, he found his neighbor, Dawn Faring, on the floor.
Emergency, what are you reporting?
I found a body. She's laying on her side. Rigor mortis has set in. Body's cold. Head's covered.
Her head is covered?
Yes.
You covered it?
No. I just checked the body to see if she was okay.
Dawn was pronounced dead at the scene.
It was total denial for me. I couldn't believe that it was happening. I mean, there's no motive. She has no enemies whatsoever.
I don't think she knew anybody. I don't think she even knew the people across the hall. She had not, as yet, said anything to any of us about the other people in the condo.
The autopsy revealed a fist-sized bruise on the back of Dawn's head. She had also been sexually assaulted and strangled to death with the bedsheet.
It appeared to us that the attack was quick. It didn't look like the suspect spent much time in the crime scene. And again, that night, no one heard or saw anything. And there's units above and below and across from her, and people were home at the time.
The one thing that the investigators knew immediately when they entered the scene was that whomever it was that did this was a smoker.
They knew this from the ashes on the mattress and the burn mark on the table where he put the cigarette out. He didn't leave the cigarette butt behind.
It means one of two things. Either he had a cigarette in his mouth when he went in, or after he realized what he's done, he said to himself, "Oh God, what am I going to do now?" And it was then that he lit the cigarette and thought about what he might do to try and cover it up or clean it up or abandon it.
There was also a blood stain on the fitted sheet. Tests showed the blood was Dawn Faring's. Investigators didn't find any foreign fingerprints or shoe impressions at the scene. None of the neighbors saw or heard anything suspicious, and nothing had been stolen from the apartment.
From a prosecutorial perspective, most of the time, you get killed for a reason. Somebody knows you, whether it's a legitimate reason or not, and most of the time it's not, but there's always a reason, almost always a reason.
In this case, there was none.
Dawn Faring led a very low-risk lifestyle. She wasn't involved in a romantic relationship. And again, her main priorities in her life at that time was her Christian faith, her family, and her studies to be a missionary.
So there were a number of times when I think we all individually and collectively looked at one another and said, "What the hell are we going to do now?"
The freshly baked chocolate chip cookies in Dawn Faring's kitchen provided an insight into her last moments alive. Grocery receipts identified the store where Dawn purchased the ingredients, and they showed that Dawn was in the store at 9:45 p.m. Investigators couldn't find anyone who had seen her between the time she left the store and when her body was discovered the following morning.
Don Fehring was an innocent victim doing the most all-American of events, which was making cookies for her mother for Mother's Day in the privacy of her own home.
It could have happened to your daughter or son. Could have happened to anyone. Just happened to be our daughter.
A background check revealed Dawn was a very private person who did not date, drink, or use drugs. She had been in town for only 2 weeks.
One of the interesting things that you learn when you do this kind of work, the medical examiner and their observations that they make of a person, and the remarkable observation that he made about Dawn Fehring was that she was so modest that she didn't even have pierced ears.
Investigators checked the whereabouts of all registered sex offenders in the area, and each of them had an alibi.
The registered sex offender who lived in this neighborhood actually had a history of abusing children and not grown women, and not to suggest that never the two shall meet, but most often you have one target group or another if you're a sex offender.
We had a number of potential leads. We had, at that time, a serial killer investigation in that part of the county was underway.
The Green River serial killer attacked dozens of women in the Pacific Northwest. But those murders differed from this one, since the Green River victims weren't killed in their homes. Investigators were fairly certain that Dawn's killer lived somewhere nearby.
We initially looked at everyone in the building. There was nothing that really stood out. People had alibis. They were pretty much accounted for. And when we ran the criminal history checks on those persons, we didn't come back with anything of concern.
And it also appeared that the killer knew Dawn lived alone.
If it had been someone who just followed her home from the grocery store or off the street, they're taking a huge chance by entering into someone's residence and gambling that they're there alone.
Although Dawn had been sexually assaulted, the medical examiner could find no biological evidence left by the perpetrator. The only possible piece of evidence was the blood stain on Dawn's bed. The blood was Dawn's. But was it possible that the blood held other clues?
The evidence techs looked at it and reviewed it. And the officer asked, what are our chances of identifying somebody with this? And in unison, they both said, slim to none.
If the killer had touched the blood, it might show his fingerprint. But the blood was on a porous bed sheet, another roadblock.
Getting prints on fabric is extremely difficult, pretty rare. There's only, not very many cases documented for that.
A quick call to the FBI's crime lab suggested they could try to see if there was a print in the blood stain with a substance called Amido Black. Amido Black has long been used on laboratory slides to enhance the contrast. It also reacts positively to the protein in blood. With nothing to lose, forensic scientist Pat Warrick took the FBI's suggestion and soaked the bedsheet in the Amido Black solution.
None of us believed in a million years that we were going to get anything out of this, because the moment this sheet went into the Amido Black solution the first time, it turned completely blue.
But to the trained eye, something did start to appear.
We just couldn't believe it. Here we have this section of fabric, this sheet, and then we can see, easily, readily see, handprints, fingerprints in blood on the sheet. And a lot of it is stuff that was not visible at all, even right before we started. And it was just covered with it.
The partial palm print that emerged didn't look like it could be used for any kind of identification. The fabric was the real problem.
You have to get in close and look for detail, ridge detail, friction ridge skin detail. So we look at it with magnification. As soon as you get in close, all you can see is the weave of the fabric. You can't really see any detail because the weave is interfering with that. That's all you can see.
The palm print now looked like a dead end. and detectives had to face the possibility that Dawn's murder would never be solved. But investigators kept digging, and being at the right place at the right time produced results. While they were standing outside Dawn's apartment, a passerby started asking questions.
I stood outside of that scene for hours, and I vividly recall standing in the parking lot and watching this big fat slob, for lack of a better term, meander down the stairs, and as he walked by all of the investigators, he sort of shouted out, "Hey man, do I have to be concerned about my personal safety around here?" Quote unquote.
His name was Eric Hayden, and he lived with his girlfriend in the apartment above Dawn Farring's.
The first time the detective spoke with Eric Hayden, he claimed he'd never seen the person who lived there before. The second time they spoke with him, he claimed that he'd seen her, but that he'd never had any contact with her at all.
When questioned about his whereabouts on the night of the murder, Hayden claimed he was out drinking with friends until very late that night. And he had no prior arrests for sex-related crimes.
We felt it was significant because this is a very unusual thing, just to wake up one day in your early 30s and go out and commit a crime like this. That's unusual.
But something about Hayden bothered the investigators.
Eric's hand was shaking. He pointed it out himself and he says, "Wow, look at me, my hands are shaking. This is really making me nervous."
Was a simple conversation with police that nerve-wracking? Or was there something else? Eric Hayden, a 32-year-old mill worker, was starting to emerge as the prime suspect in Dawn Farring's murder. He lived in the same apartment building, and according to other residents, Hayden behaved suspiciously.
There was a female neighbor that described Eric Hayden as weird. And when I asked her, "What do you mean by weird?" she said, "Well, on one occasion I saw him down in the parking lot. It was raining, he didn't have any shoes on, and he was smoking a cigarette, and he was watching people come and go. And as I watched him, I realized he was paying particular attention to the women."
And during questioning, Hayden initially claimed he was out drinking with friends at the time of the murder. Later, he said he was drinking alone.
When his story started changing, they considered the fact he admittedly drinks to the point where he doesn't know what's going on.
Hayden was also a smoker, which was significant since the killer left cigarette ashes behind. But the only forensic evidence in this crime was the palm print on Dawn's bedsheet. And the print was so poor, there was no way to make a comparison. Desperate for answers, detectives called in forensic investigator Eric Berg.
They wanted another opinion on whether or not something could be done with those sheets, since they had reached the limit of what they were able to do with chemistry.
Berg took a digital photograph of the print on the bedsheet and scanned it into his computer. The problem was immediately apparent. The ridge details on the print were obscured by the thread patterns on the sheet, as if a screen had been placed over the print.
"Well, I want to find out who left this because I think it's my bad guy. I see the outline of a hand, but I can't see the details. How do I get rid of that screen? That's really the question I'm asking myself when I'm looking at the screen. How do I get rid of that?"
Then Berg had an idea. He needed some way to remove the thread pattern from the image, but he needed to find some kind of filter.
"The filter is a nice word for algorithm. It's a mathematical process that can go through an image and do something to it. We have one that I designed that basically seeks out repetitive patterns, something that repeats itself in a predictable way and allows you to remove that without affecting the rest of the image."
Berg took a sample of the bedsheet's thread pattern and had the computer subtract that pattern from the image, leaving only the palm print. And it worked.
"It was beautiful. I didn't expect this, or I didn't expect it to be that clear, but details were suddenly just the HDTV analogy that were popping off the screen that you did not see before. I mean, you could see formations but you weren't seeing the details, and now all of a sudden you're seeing those details.
And there was a remarkable amount of detail.
Here we have pretty much half of a hand from the fingers all the way down to the base of the hand that's in view, that is readily visible. So we had just a tremendous amount of information as far as doing a latent print examination or a comparison.
The digitally enhanced palm print from Dawn Ferring's bedsheet was then compared to Eric Hayden's palm prints. Pat Warrick focused on the ridge patterns and breaks in the patterns. These are unique to each person. There was no doubt. The print on Dawn Ferring's bedsheet was made by Eric Hayden.
So we call him and just said, you're not going to believe it. It's the guy who lives upstairs. You know, it's him. And they just were like, what? You know, and it was just amazing. We're like, yeah, it matches the card that we have. It matches him.
Eric Hayden was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Prosecutors were convinced they had an ironclad case. But would the judge allow this evidence to be used in court? As Eric Hayden awaited trial for the murder of Dawn Ferring, prosecutors had to deal with a number of problems. The technology used to reveal the print had never been admitted as evidence in a criminal trial.
The standard argument in this particular type of case is that the evil empire, the cops are out there and they're just trying to convict innocent people out here of murder and all kinds of terrible crimes. And they'll stop at nothing to do that, including taking computer evidence, manipulating it, adding information, putting stuff in there that would unfairly bias the case against their client.
When prosecutors walked into court, they had to convince the judge that the only thing they did to the palm print on the sheet was to enhance it.
We don't add anything to the evidence. The evidence is what it is. We will take away that is interfering with our ability to identify, subtracting, but we're not going to put in a fingerprint ridge or a palm detail or anything that's missing.
The judge left it to the jury to decide. Eric Berg brought his computer into the courtroom and demonstrated the process.
Everybody looked at it and they were just amazed.
It was readily apparent that it was a palm print, and I remember I was standing back behind the jury, looking at them, look at Eric Berg, and in the background was the defense counsel, who took one look at me and threw his tie over his shoulder and spun around in the chair and just essentially saying, I'm done. And for all practical purposes, Eric Hayden was done.
The palm print told the story of what happened to Dawn Ferring. Prosecutors believe Eric Hayden was drunk when he returned to his apartment on the night of the murder. As he walked up the stairs to his apartment, he noticed Dawn's door was slightly ajar. She may have left it open because of the heat from baking the cookies. The evidence shows Hayden struck Dawn on the back of her head, knocking her down. Then sexually assaulted her and strangled her with the bedsheet. As he got up, he steadied himself on the mattress, placing a partial bloody palm print on the sheet. He smoked a cigarette while trying to compose himself, not knowing that the palm print, later enhanced by computer technology, clearly placed him at the scene.
This is the classic example of investigators, trained investigators, walking into a scene and having the good sense to preserve something, whether it's going to turn into a piece of evidence or not. Doing nothing to contaminate or screw it up before they get it to the people who do know what can be done with it.
Eric Hayden was convicted and sentenced to 26 years in prison. After the trial, Dawn Ferring's friends and family set up a scholarship in her name for students who wish to do missionary work.
There's been over $20,000 that's been working in the world that would not have been there if it hadn't been for her death.
The technology used in Dawn's case set a legal precedent and is now used in cases all over the world.
It was the first time anywhere in the world that crime laboratory folks were able to identify handprint impressions, finger or palm handprint impressions, left in blood on a woven piece of fabric.
I'm blown away looking back on this some 11 years later that people are still referring to this case and using the technology that was used in it. We had no idea at the time how significant this was going to be.
I don't think God causes things to happen, but he makes use of them. And the timing to me is just amazing that this technology had just been found at the time when it was needed for solving Dawn's case.